If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
In this ad for the Mobil 1 brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobil 1, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
Hello, and welcome to the first part of BBC History Magazine's March 2009 podcast. I'm Sue Wingrove, and I'm the acting editor of the magazine.
And I'm Rob Attar, section editor of the magazine.
Coming up in this podcast,
trials for criminal conversation were usually brought about by an aggrieved husband who felt that he could get some sort of financial reparations from the man who had effectively damaged his property, and his wife, of course, being his property.
That was Hallie Rubenhold talking about an 18th century tale of adultery and greed that helped introduce changes to the divorce laws of Britain.
That's the problem people have with Richard. How could a good man become such an evil monster in overnight?
And that was David Hipshon, who will be telling us about the brutal slaying of Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. We'll hear more on these topics in a moment. And of course, they're explored in the March 2009 issue of BBC History Magazine, which features Richard III on the cover.
And if you're not familiar with the magazine, it is produced by BBC Magazines in the United Kingdom. It comes out monthly, and you can get it delivered to you anywhere in the world. We'll give details of how to subscribe later on in this podcast.
Now, historian Hallie Rubenhold is the author of The Covent Garden Ladies, Pimp General Jack, and the Extraordinary Story of Harris's List. Her latest book is Lady Worsley's Whim, an 18th century tale of sex, scandal and divorce. In our March issue, she describes how the Worsley's divorce case helped to discredit a law that treated married women as chattels. I spoke to her earlier to find out more about this sordid and scandalous affair. In 1780, Joshua Reynolds exhibited one of his most glorious paintings, a full-length portrait of the beautiful Lady Worsley, dressed in a blazing red riding habit and standing in a proud posture with one hand on her hip, the other swishing a riding crop. Her head is turned to one side so we can see her aristocratic profile, and her full skirt accentuates her tiny waist. Now, Reynolds also painted one of her husband, Sir Richard, in his red regimental uniform of the South Hampshire Militia, and the two paintings were intended to be a pair, but in fact they were never hung together, and here to tell us why is historian Hallie Rubenhold. Hello, Hallie.
Hello.
I believe the trouble began when Lady Worsley fell in love with her husband's best friend. What happened next?
Yes, they were neighbours on the Isle of Wight. Sir Richard Worsley owned the estate of Appleburkham, and George Morris Bissett was his neighbour, and he owned Knight and Gorges. And the two gentlemen met each other in the course of the 1780 election, and at the same time Lady Worsley was introduced to Morris Bissett as well, and the three of them became very good friends, and perhaps even more than very good friends. Well, we know they became more than very good friends. The relationship between the two men is rather questionable as well. We know that they took a house together in Maidstone and lived as a type of menage a trois. And that happened at the time when Sir Richard Worsley, his regiment of the South Hampshire Militia, was stationed at Cox Heath, where a number of militias were stationed in order to drill over the summer in preparation for a possible French invasion. And they enjoyed a very close relationship. As I said, they lived together in this house. And eventually, Lady Worsley and George Bissett, after she became pregnant with his child and gave birth to it, and Sir Richard actually gave the child his name and recognized it as his, although he knew it wasn't by his issue. Lady Worsley and George Bissett decided that although the menage a trois in which they were living was nice, they actually preferred to go off, the two of them. And so they eloped in November 1781, and they ran off to London together in the hope that Sir Richard Worsley would begin divorce proceedings. And of course, he didn't do exactly that, and he also began proceedings for something called criminal conversation as well. So that he didn't actually do what they had expected him to do at all, which rather threw a spanner into the works.
So he entered into this criminal conversation suit. Now, what was criminal conversation?
Criminal conversation is actually a rather antiquated legal way of saying adultery or having sex with another man's wife. Trials for criminal conversation were usually brought about by an aggrieved husband who felt that he could get some sort of financial reparations from the man who had effectively damaged his property, and his wife, of course, being his property, by soiling her, by potentially turning her into a really kind of a spoiled good, if you think about it, because the integrity of a woman's virtue, as it was called in the 18th century, or chastity, was really paramount to ensuring that your line of succession wasn't corrupted. And so if a woman had sex with another man, there was absolutely, you know, nothing really to guarantee that you didn't have a cuckoo in your nest. So that was one reason why adultery at this time was frowned upon, particularly in the 18th century when people were very worried about dynastic issues and the exchange of property and money. Criminal conversation was also a way in which a husband who had felt that his honour had been damaged by this interloper could actually restore his honour in a very public environment. While dueling was increasingly frowned upon in the 18th century, there had to be some other way in which the honour of a man who had wronged him by him could be resurrected. And so trials in court came to take the place of duels between gentlemen.
So it was a very public form of almost revenge, retribution. It was a way of settling it to everyone's satisfaction, to the husband's satisfaction. So the trial of Worsley versus Bissett was heard on the 21st of February 1782. So this was very much a public trial, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was something that the general public could go and witness, and not just the Worsley's criminal conversation trial, but criminal conversation trials in general were considered a type of public spectacle, and they took place in a corner of Westminster Hall, and it was wide open for anybody to walk in whenever they wanted to. And of course, everybody knew about the scandal of Lady Worsley running off of George Bissett, because the newspapers had beaten them to it and had trumpeted this news all over the broadsheets. And so there was quite an enormous turnout. And in the gallery, there were, oh gosh, a large variety of people, everyone from journalists to court reporters who were taking transcripts of the proceedings, which they would then sell on to a publisher, to ladies of some ill repute who liked to make public appearances at these things, to obviously friends and family, well-wishers of the two parties concerned to, you know, just curious individuals who wanted to see what was going on. So it was quite a circus, and it played to a packed house. It was like a type of theatre, really.
It was a real washing of dirty laundry in public, wasn't it? And it became known as one of the most infamous cases of criminal conversation in history. Why was this a particularly vicious battle?
It was a very, very ugly battle. And there are a number of cases in the 18th century where battles continue outside of the courtroom. You know, this was a time when literacy was increasing, as were the amount of printed publications at this time. So people could read more about issues, they could engage in debates. And anybody who had an axe to grind was going to use this to their advantage. So one of the reasons why the Worthies trial became so well known was not only was it so incredibly scandalous, because there was a very unorthodox line of defence for George Bissett that was taken, which basically publicly ruined Lady Worsley's character. But Lady Worsley and Sir Richard Worsley took their battle outside of the courtroom. This continued to rage for months, and there were pamphlets published where she was giving her side of events and then he was defending himself. But then everybody else wanted a piece of the action as well. Anything to come out of this trial, any sort of scandal, would sell publications. And so there were a number of hacks who wanted to provide the public with further details of what was going on. And so they wrote further adventures of Sir Richard and Lady Worsley. You know, whether these are true is open to question. The transcripts were selling like hotcakes, and people were queuing up around the corners of the booksellers to get their hands on them. It went into at least 8 editions. And then on top of that, it seemed to really capture the public imagination, and especially the imagination of engravers and caricaturists. And so you had an entire series of caricatures which came out of this trial, and lampoons. And some of them are very, very well known, and some particularly well known ones by Gilray.
Now, I believe a key event was what happened at a Maidstone bathhouse.
The Maidstone whim was the event on which the entire trial hinged. And basically, what had happened was that on a very warm summer's day, or late summer's day in September, Sir Richard and George Bissett and Lady Worsley had gone down to the Maidstone bathhouse, a cold bathhouse, for a swim. And there was a ladies' entrance and a gentleman's entrance. And Sir Richard and Bissett went round to the gentlemen's, and Lady Worsley went into the ladies, and they had their swim, and then they came back to wait for her outside of the ladies' entrance. And they thought it would be rather fun to, you know, just sort of have a bit of a lark. And Sir Richard knocked on the door and said that he was going to show George Bissett a view of his wife through the bathhouse window. Well, of course, you know, this was all just, you know, part of the course. You know, there's three people living in a menage a trois, and, you know, there was nobody around, and they thought this was perfectly fine. And so Sir Richard lifted up George Bissett to the window of the bathhouse, where he could see Lady Worsley dressing. And he held him in place for 5 minutes. What they forgot, and what many people in the 18th century tended to forget, were the presence of servants. And in the bathhouse was the bathing woman called Mary Marriott. And Mary Marriott saw everything that happened. And it was her testimony that Sir Richard helped George Bissett to a view of his wife, and therefore was very much aware of this affair, that he was not an innocent party in it at all. Her evidence actually turned this criminal conversation trial, and where Sir Richard Worsley had asked for astronomical damages of £20,000, this evidence given by Mary Marriott basically proved that he shouldn't really get anything, and so he was only awarded nominal damages of 1 shilling.
I mean, there's a wonderful Gilray cartoon of the bathhouse incident showing Sir Richard hoisting Bissett on his shoulders and Bissett's having a jolly good look through the window. And the caption underneath reads, "Sir Richard worse than sly, exposing his wife's bottom. Oh, fie." Hallie, thanks very much for talking to us today. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
In this ad for the Mobile One brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
And that was Hallie Reubenhold, talking about her new book, Lady Worsley's Whim, published by Chatto and Windus. In a moment, we'll be taking a look at Richard III's brutal death at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. But first, here are some details of how you can subscribe to BBC History Magazine.
Yes, Sue. UK listeners who subscribe to BBC History Magazine before the 31st of March can save £1 on every issue. That works out at just £2.60 an issue. For more details, go to www.subscribeonline.co.uk/History Magazine or call us on 0844 844 0250 and quote the code POD0309. And if you're listening to this podcast outside the UK, you'll be pleased to learn that you can get the magazine sent to you anywhere in the world. Just call us on plus 44 1795 44728 for details.
Now, Richard III is perhaps one of British history's most controversial figures, largely because he's suspected of having murdered his nephews, the princes in the Tower. Richard was himself killed at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, and earlier, the magazine's editor, David Musgrove, spoke to historian David Hipshon about the events leading up to the king's betrayal and his brutal death on that fateful day.
David, you've just been working on a new book about Richard III, and you've written a feature for us in the magazine about the Battle of Bosworth and what happened to Richard there. So perhaps you could just try and paint me a verbal picture of what was happening in August 1485 as we run up towards the Battle of Bosworth.
Right. Well, firstly, Richard's only been on the throne 2 years, and things are rather unsettled. And I think that two-year period is rather interesting because Henry Tudor, he's landed at Milford Haven a few weeks earlier, and he's coming to try to take the throne off Richard. Well, it's rather odd because he doesn't stand a chance. And I don't think anyone who was a betting man would have betted against Richard winning the battle that's about to happen. He's king. He's the brother of the former king. He's had military victories before in Scotland. And he's a foremost, I would say, commander of men. So this man, Henry Tudor, has never been in a battle in his life. He's got a few followers, and he's sort of meandering his way across the Welsh border in towards Leicester, where Richard is going to wait for him. He's moved from Nottingham very quickly, and it's a whole very, very odd situation. But Richard usurped the throne 2 years earlier, and he killed his nephews in order to do so. Now, that, I think, is the problem, because once you've got a usurpation at any time in history, you've upset the apple cart and you've made opportunities available for any chancer. And I think this is what Henry Tudor is in 1485. There are opportunities. The glittering prize of monarchy is there for anyone. Buckingham, who supported Richard in his usurpation in 1483, rebels against him. And in that rebellion, you find Henry Tudor's mother making alliance with Richard III's niece. Now, that, I think, is crucial, because suddenly Henry Tudor is a viable alternative to Richard. But this has always happened. Every time you have a usurpation, a few years afterwards, someone tries to go for the throne, and they're usually squashed. It happens when Henry IV comes to the throne in 1399. He has to get rid of Hotspur. Does so at Battle of Shrewsbury. It happens after Bosworth, when Henry Tudor himself fights a battle at Stoke in 1487. No one really tends to think about that battle. So I think what's happening is a kind of inevitable reaction to a usurpation, you could say. But it should have been snuffed out, and it shouldn't have led to a major battle.
Okay, so we get to Bosworth, we get to this major battle, and that pitches Henry Tudor, as you say, against Richard III. Now the Bosworth is famous for being Richard's end. It's when Richard meets his demise. So
that's right.
What's the traditional view for the reason for Richard III's untimely end at Bosworth?
Yes, what I think historians tend to do, and have done rather carelessly over the years, is associate Richard's death at Bosworth in battle with his seizing the throne 2 years earlier, where he has to put aside his nephews. And they assume that the reason he loses at Bosworth is because he hasn't got much support because of the horrendous deed. And even though we're living in brutal times in the 15th century, just at the end of the Wars of the Roses, nevertheless, even then, they see it as a dreadful crime, because his nephew, Edward, was only 12 and he was innocent. You can't blame him for anything. He hadn't had a chance to prove himself even incompetent. So it's a crime. And they suggest that that's why Richard didn't have much support, particularly among the gentry, they say, at Bosworth. And that's why Henry Tudor was able to win. That's a sort of traditional view.
And I suppose that's all part of the general blackening of Richard's reputation, which has perhaps happened over the years from Shakespeare onwards, I suppose. So how are you revising that view? What do you see that's different?
Well, the fact is that Richard had plenty of support at Bosworth. The crucial problem for him was he didn't have the right support. And the reason for that was he'd annoyed two of the protagonists, that is Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, and Thomas Lord Stanley. These two magnates were two out of three major magnates that were fighting for Richard. So they are rather crucial. But the reason they don't support him at Bosworth is not because they don't like him for having killed his nephew. It's because of their own self-interest entirely. And what's more, Henry Percy's lack of participation is controversial. He might have participated if he could have done. I think the battle just went adrift and he couldn't quite follow it. So we'll even leave him out of the equation. He doesn't like Richard because Richard is taking all his authority in the north. But it's the other guy, Thomas Stanley, who's famous for swinging battles and switching. He's a famous fence sitter, a trimmer. He has been throughout the Wars of the Roses. He and his brother William have done this throughout the Wars of the Roses. They've decided which side to support when they've seen which side is winning. But he's got particular reasons for disliking Richard, and he takes advantage of an opportunity that just happens to arise in the moment on the battlefield to do the deed, come in and kill Richard, throw his forces against his own king. And he does it for particular reasons. His power in Cheshire and South Lancashire has been challenged by Richard.
And that's it's sort of a slightly provincial issue, isn't it? It's not really so much of a national concern then.
I think that's right. I think Richard has got around him a bunch of highly loyal northern gentry. He's had to use those because basically he hasn't had time to build up what we call an affinity. His brother did that, Edward IV, by marrying Elizabeth Woodville controversially and flooding the court with all her relatives. Richard hasn't had an opportunity to secure men loyal to himself. He tried, but the rebellion of Buckingham in 1483 proved that the old adherents of his brother were not going to swing to him. So he uses his northerners, and these are very powerful gentry. They can muster about 300 or 400 men each, and they are long-time, long-serving friends of Richard. But he's been promoting them into posts round Stanley's territory in Lancashire and Cheshire, and he doesn't like that Stanley. In fact, there have been feuds going on there between Stanley and a particular family in Richard's entourage, the Harringtons, which I think explodes into the death of Richard at Bosworth Field. James Harrington is by Richard at the battle, and so is Robert Harrington. And Stanley sees the chance, and it's just too good to miss. And by killing those Harringtons, he gains quite a substantial amount of authority on the Lancashire border.
Okay. Now, have you studied any new documents? Have you found any new sources to support this? Or is this a different reading of the normal sources that historians would look at for this period?
Well, this arose out of... I was doing a dissertation under Rosemary Horrocks at Cambridge in about 2002, and she directed me towards the National Archives, where the Duchy of Lancaster records kept. And I was just reading through those. They haven't been printed or transcribed, as it happens. And it was quite clear that there was a major dispute going on between Thomas, Lord Stanley, and the Harrington brothers, James and Robert, over a particular place, Hornby Castle, in Lancashire. And it rumbled on, and I kept finding this. And I was wondering why no one had sort of made more of it. In fact, my supervisor at Cambridge, Rosemary Horrocks, does actually mention it in her book, Richard III, A Study in Service. But it's the implications of it sort of slowly dawned, I think, and then I realised this story needed to be told.
Okay, and my final point, which I would put to anyone who's telling us about Richard III in the magazine, is, and I'm sure you'll have a view on this, is why on earth this man still maintains such a hold on people today? There are, you know, there are several Richard III societies, and yes, any mention of him will no doubt lead to cries of foul play or good cheer about him. So yes, what is it about him that makes him?
Well, I think
so,
it's this, that until he seizes the throne in 1483, he's been an impeccably courageous servant of the crown of his brother Edward IV. He's a man who believes in justice. Even during his reign, his only parliament in 1484 passes some significant acts which help common people. He begins what later became the Court of Requests. It's a council of requests in his reign. He allows bail to people accused of crimes. Previously, they could just be banged up and all their property taken. So he's doing good things. And people can't really understand, I think, and this is a fascination, this dichotomy. How can such a man of integrity and probity, a servant, a man who's loyal, suddenly turn against all those principles, seize his nephew, both his nephews, put them in the tower, the princes in the tower, do them to death, supposedly, although there's no evidence, actually, of his involvement in that, and then become this monster, this Tudor monster? Surely that's the problem people have with Richard. How could a good man become such an evil monster in overnight? And I don't think there's ever going to be a real resolution to that. I think that I can understand why he did what he did in 1483. It was a matter of security, and I don't think he wanted the Wars of the Roses to carry on again, which they would have probably done under Edward V. But nevertheless, we've got to think of Edward V. He was an innocent lad, and I think that's the fundamental issue. It's fascinated generations, because that act has kind of obliterated his previous record.
And just a very final point then, just what's your take on Richard III? Is he the hunchback monster, or is he a good man, really?
I think he was a good man who attempted to do his best, but he is a medieval man. He is a 15th century man, and he's not a pussycat, this man. He simply wasn't going to tolerate a return, I think, to the form of factionalism. And I think also he wanted to live the life that his father, Richard Duke of York, attempted to live, which is putting people first. So I tend to be, I think, favourable towards Richard.
David Hipshon, many thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
And that was our editor, David Musgrove, talking to David Hipshon, whose book, Richard III and the Death of Chivalry, is to be published by the History Press. You can find out more by reading his feature in the March issue of BBC History magazine.
That brings us to the end of this podcast from BBC History magazine. For more on these topics, plus all our other features, do look out for the March issue of the magazine. You might also want to check out our website, where you can subscribe to the magazine, buy recommended history books through our BBC History bookstore, or download previous podcasts. The address is www.bbchistorymagazine.com.